is Let's Talk Legal on the Talk Station, FM 107.1. And joining us today, we have Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. And as we begin the program, just to remind you, that phone number, 252 area code 726-9050, 726-9050. Their website, harvellandcollins.com, very easy to remember, but do spell out the word and, harvellandcollins.com. And with that, good afternoon, Cecil.
Good afternoon, Lockwood.
And to you, Wes, likewise, good afternoon.
Yes, sir. Good afternoon, Lockwood.
Lockwood, we will begin the subject today, and probably we'll talk about it next week as well, of homeowners associations. We'll start today kind of with the big picture in terms of kind of what they are and how they operate, how they get established, things of that nature, and then we'll move forward from there. But basically, a homeowners association is an organization of lot owners, homeowners, within a given space, within a given community. They can be very large at times, you know, with many, many homeowners, all part of one particular association. Sometimes there are situations where there is the association for a certain area within the development, and then yet another association for the, say, the yacht club, the marina, mm-hmm, area, and yet another association maybe for the golfing region within the development. So they can be very simple, or they can be more complex. I think that the important thing to know, a few things to know, is that, you know, when we buy a property that is governed by a homeowners association, then, you know, Lockwood, we are subject to their rules and regulations and their bylaws and their restrictions. And it's very important as a buyer that we understand the restrictions and the covenants and the bylaws, the financial viability of the association. You don't want to close on a home within a subdivision all excited about the fact that you're going to keep your, you know, Boston Whaler out front and find out that you can't keep a boat on a trailer on your lot, mm-hmm, on your property, except for, you know, maybe overnight or something of that nature. You're excited about your children having an outside basketball goal, and you can't have a basketball, mm-hmm, goal. You want to paint your door forest green, and all doors have to be painted a certain color.
Wow.
So, I mean, Lockwood, you know, association, homeowner association regulations are there ahead of time, and we need to look at them carefully when we're in the buying mode. Caveat emptor, buyer beware. Your homeownership is going to be subject to these covenants that are on record. They need to be looked at carefully. You don't want to buy into a condominium association, let's say, which is a type of homeowners association, and find out that there is an ongoing $10,000 assessment for the next 5 years.
Right.
If you know about that and you buy notwithstanding, then fine. But you don't want it to come as a surprise. You don't want it to come as a surprise that they've been putting off an assessment to redo a particular structure within, mm-hmm, the condominium association. Maybe it's the heating and air conditioning for the common areas, or the parking lot, or the roof system, or the pools and tennis courts. And then you all of a sudden are a buyer, and 1 or 2 years later, after being a very new, having been an owner for only a year or so, you're at the meeting and discover that there'll be, you know, this $10,000 or $20,000 assessment. Well, more than likely, you know, Lockwood, that got discussed at the meeting last year. You weren't a homeowner last year, so you weren't at that meeting, but it was something that has not just come out of the woodwork. It's been discussed for a few years, maybe been put off, and now all of a sudden, you know, it's front and center. So being a part of a homeowners association is a bit like being a part of a democracy. You're going to be subject to the opinions and votes of others within your community.
You mentioned two things. One of, obviously, caveat emptor, being aware of previous concerns, and also the issue of financial viability. And I want to reference back the conversation we had last week on the topic of full disclosure to the buyers. My first question on the issue of financial responsibility, is that something that should be included in the agreement, the purchase agreement on the part of the buyer? In other words, if I'm buying property from Wes, for example, and it's a part of a homeowners association, the financial structure of the HOA or the condominium association, should that be part of a disclosure in advance?
Well, as far as a disclosure goes, you know, if you're going to buy there, I think that particular information may be limited, like in a paper form.
Okay.
As far as what they would provide you. I mean, I'm not really used to seeing situations where, you know, there's an inquiry with regard to the financial condition of the association. And along with that inquiry, that response comes, you know, the Homeowners Association's bank statement.
Right.
Balance sheet, you know, things like that. But, you know, that is certainly a reasonable question to ask your realtor about. So if you're dealing with a realtor as a buyer's agent, and you can certainly inquire about, you know, what can we do to determine what is going on financially with the association? Kind of a broad question there.
Okay, but it's pretty obvious, and back to you on this one, Cecil, you're saying we're having to, you know, caveat emptor, we need to be aware. You're buying into more than just a building or a property. You're buying into an association. Am I correct on that?
That's correct. Your property, your deed, your ownership in that property is subject to the restrictions, covenants, agreements, easements that are on record mm-hmm. at that time. Anything real estate has to be in writing and has to be recorded. That's a general rule,
right,
in order to be enforceable. So you're not going to buy a piece of property and then, you know, a year later find out that there is a restriction or something concerning that property that was, quote, not on record, that is enforceable. There might be something out there that's kind of unknown, hidden, you know, something of that nature, but that's rare. These restrictions are out there. And Wes is that, and covenants, I think, is a word that's interchangeable with restriction. Sometimes they're called covenants. Sometimes they're called restrictive covenants. Sometimes just restrictions. The bottom line is that they touch and concern our ownership and property. And it's absolutely a legitimate question, as Wes was referring, to have the association render financial records, to maybe have a conversation with the association president,
right,
the association treasurer.
Whoa.
To if you're lucky enough, maybe attend a board meeting
mm-hmm.
Before you know close. I certainly have had clients do that because it just happens to be at a time.
Right.
There's nothing more telling than to attend a board meeting and listen to what is happening, and then, you know, your contract is for closure a month or two later. The bottom line is to be aware of this, that's why we're talking about it today with you, Lockwood, is to be, you know, a lot of folks just simply aren't aware. They're shocked and bewildered with
right.
some very simple fundamental things, and that's not where we want our clients to be.
Yeah, of course, there's a lot of homeowners associations, and they're growing in number of variety and types.
Yeah, I was going to connect this to our conversation last week. We talked about the residential property disclosure statement.
Right.
And, you know, that being a document that when there is a residential property being sold, then these representations are made either yes, no, or I don't know with regard to certain aspects of the property that's being sold. One of the line items with regard to that has to do with special assessments
mm-hmm.
or assessments on the property. So I would, you know, caution buyers and recommend to buyers to look closely at that residential property disclosure statement regarding that line item, and that will give you some direction with regard to, you know, what you would expect regarding assessments. That's pretty easy to determine because that's a ongoing, normally, you know, sometimes it's an annual thing, quarterly thing, sometimes it's a monthly thing, but you can make that determination.
Mm-hmm.
But where you, there can be a real surprise is if there is a special assessment that, like
right.
Cecil was just mentioning, a large assessment for doing some type of repairs or some type of, you know, replacement of a wastewater treatment facility or whatever it may be. So look closely at the residential property disclosure statement. You know, that should have some information on it.
Okay.
Also from a financial standpoint, just right around the neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
are there potholes in the roads? What condition is the common area in?
Right.
Is there a tennis court? Is the tennis court kept up okay? Is the pool kept up okay? Are the grounds groomed okay? Well, I mean, if you've got, you know, problems with regard to that, then that may lead you to questions with regard to, you know, why is the general subdivision not being maintained very well? Do we have a financial problem? That type of thing.
Obviously, there may be an ongoing assessment. Would that be disclosed in the, you know, the transaction of purchaser buying the property? Would the ongoing assessment, would that be part of the disclosure? And then another question, in instances where the current property owner is possibly in arrears for assessments or maybe homeowner's dues, does that responsibility accrue to the individual or to the property? Can it be applied to the property? Because these are questions that I think a lot of people ignore, quite frankly, when it comes to buying a piece of property that has a homeowners association.
Right. So if there are liens on the property,
mm-hmm.
okay, that you're buying, if we're talking about a purchase, then and those liens can come from assessments or dues not being paid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they could come from fines, like, for example, if someone is in violation of the covenants, maybe they built something on the property without approval,
uh-huh.
or maybe they violated the covenants in some other way, and they continue to do so, and the association has gone through the proper procedure for fining that individual, which normally falls under what's called the Planned Community Act, and the maximum of the fines is $100 per day. And there's a whole procedure about that that we can talk about if you'd like to. Then those fines or dues and assessments can ripen to the point where they become a lien on the property, and then the association would file a notice of lien on the property, and that's a cloud on title. It's just like a mortgage is on the title,
uh-huh.
or, you know, any other kind of encumbrance, you know, on the title. It would pop up in the title search. So your question would be, are those personal? Or your question was, are those personal? Meaning, do they go to the individual or do they go to the property? Well, certainly they go to the property.
Okay.
Okay, so certainly those are a lien on the title. So in the event of a sale, then that is, in order to convey good title, that has to be, those have to be paid off. So that's going to be, it's not going to increase the purchase price. It's going to come out of the proceeds to uh-huh. the seller. You know, it's just like paying off a mortgage,
mm-hmm.
you know, so on and so forth.
We're talking.
However, I would also say that look at your governing documents as it relates to whether those liens, fines, assessments, for example, are personal. Because if your governing documents allow them to be a personal obligation as well, then they go beyond just the title of the property. They're actually, you know, there can be a collection against other assets for them as well. So. That it's a little bit of a complicated answer there, but that's the way that works.
I appreciate the comment that it's a complicated answer, but this is a complicated situation. We're talking with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins. That was Wes Collins just a moment ago here on Harvell and Collins. Let's Talk Legal. As we are preparing to take a break, I just want to remind you, if you want to reach out to the folks at Harvell and Collins, you can give them a call at 252-726-9050, 726-9050. Location is 1107 Bridges Street in Morehead City. And their web address or their website is harvellandcollins.com. Spell out the word and, harvellandcollins.com. we're talking, let's talk legal here on the Talk Station. We've got Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins, and we're talking about homeowners associations. And in many regards, this conversation spins off our conversation from last week on the issue of real estate and disclosure forms and the requirements of the seller and the buyer. And in particular note, Cecil, is you've mentioned several times, buyer beware. It's really, a lot of this has to do with the being the buyer being, I should say, aggressive, but being diligent in determining all the restrictions associated with their homes. And particularly when it comes to common areas and things of this nature, this seems to me that it's a topic that quite often doesn't get discussed until after the fact.
Well, we can go back a little bit and kind of go into kind of philosophy, a law question a little bit, Lockwood. There has to be kind of a line in the sand, and so the philosophy of law that supports the concept of caveat emptor is that, look, the buyer has every opportunity to investigate the property mm-hmm. before they close. They have every opportunity to look at these things that are a public record, and they do have to be a public record. Okay. If there's something that's not a public record, then potentially that will be an issue that our law firm will have to discuss and with you. But both things are a public record. We've just concluded a case in our office successfully with a homeowners association where there was a lawsuit. We had to file a lawsuit against a particular individual who had adversely affected the subdivision in its entirety.
Wow.
There were some faulty deeds that were signed that were misrepresented, and the developer, who was an elderly person, did not know exactly what they were signing at the time, and so the entire subdivision now was unfortunately affected by these transfers. Well, lo and behold, of course, again, we were able to get that case resolved, but the bottom line is that there were recorded documents on that. There was a lawsuit, and so any potential buyer would have been able to see that, gosh, I'm buying in a subdivision, but there's an ongoing lawsuit,
right.
And maybe I want to talk to the lawyer, maybe I want to talk to the president of the association, I want to know a little bit more about this before I buy into the property. Once we do buy, then there's that line in the sand that the law would then say generally that, well, you knew because you had the opportunity to investigate mm-hmm. the concept of caveat emptor. You had the opportunity. You bought the property in its current and subject condition with all of the appropriate, you know, pending lawsuits, pending easements, pending restrictions. And so you therefore are not able to, we want finality in the law. You're not able to come back later and say, well, you know, I've changed my mind. I have buyer's remorse. You need to do that before you close. And trust me, that does happen. We're dealing with that right now on a property that's in an estate that we're handling. And while we've had two or three different contracts fall through, which is all a part of this concept of what we're talking about today, caveat emptor. The buyers are going by, they're contracting on the property, but then they're finding things that they don't like. Their inspections are coming back in a negative way. We now have discovered that there maybe is on this property a buried fuel tank, mm-hmm. okay? And so it's become complicated. As a result of that, the buyers are doing what they're supposed to do, which is to back away. They're not real excited about this property anymore.
Right.
And so that's the way the law works. That's a long and storied history. Case law after case after case after case supports this back and forth between the buyer and the seller, this discovery period. Last week we talked about, you know, the due diligence mm-hmm. period. That's the way it has to work, because once there's a closing, then the title vest in the new buyer, and the buyer is going to take on all of those responsibilities.
All right, Cecil, Wes, you mentioned a moment ago the governing documents. And again, That's pretty important in light of the fact that you have certain responsibilities, assessments, adjustments in fees based on annual adjustments, things of this nature. My question, and you said a moment ago, Cecil Public Records, where, again, I'm buying a piece of property. Where do I go to get these governing documents? And again, is it my responsibility or is it, if you will, the representative's responsibility, either the seller's representative or the buyer's representative, to make me aware of those governing documents? Where do we find them? And because you mentioned a moment ago, public records.
It would be the buyer's responsibility to review them.
Okay.
There's no like legal duty to provide these documents by the seller. Okay, so, but in many cases, when you're a buyer and you're buying into property or considering buying into property in an association, there will be a packet of information that will be provided, you know, by the listing agent, the realtor for the seller. And where do you go to get those in addition to that? The answer to that question is some of the documents would be in the chain of title. So the closing attorney could certainly pull the latest declarations or covenants. Those are the restrictions on property, same term, those synonymous terms, declaration or covenants. So those would be in the chain of title. And those would be, I would say, the most important document documents, because that document would indicate what the restrictions on your property are,
okay,
such as the things that Cecil was referring to earlier about being able to park a boat in the driveway and having a basketball goal and what color your door is and your mailbox and all that square footage, all that type of stuff. So that is readily available in the chain of title. The bylaws would not be recorded in most situations. Sometimes bylaws are recorded, but they don't have to be. The bylaws, normally you can just request those. Sometimes with some associations, they have all that information online, by the way. They have just a website for the subdivision, and they have the governing documents. But you can request that, and the bylaws aren't going to be really restrictions on the property. It's going to be how the corporation, the nonprofit corporation, which is, you know, the officers, the directors, how they are required to operate the corporation, when the annual meetings are, the notice requirements, these type things. So not so much restrictions. Another important document to take into consideration would be rules and regulations.
Okay.
And that's also a restriction on property because it's an indication of how, you know, what rules there are. Normally these rules and regulations are going to be limited to the common area. But I've certainly seen rules and regulations or an attempt to use rules and regulations to regulate the particular individual properties. Those rules and regulations in many cases are not recorded. They're not in the chain of title. And depending on how those are done and whether there's a reference in the covenants as to rules and regulations, whether they're incorporated therein, there will be a question mark about whether they're enforceable or not. Because sometimes you see associations attempt to impose rules and regulations on folks' property in an improper way, and they really would not be enforceable. Because you can't just willy-nilly say, oh, we're going to make up this rule that you can't have a boat in your driveway. Well, that would not be enforceable if the covenants had no such restriction in it when you bought your property.
Okay.
That would be, I mean, because you have to go through a procedure in order to have that type of restriction, because the law is going to err on the side of no restrictions on your property. If you're going to restrict someone's use in their property, you have to do it in a certain way. You have to put the person on notice by it being in the chain of title. It has to be in a proper, properly adopted, you know, restriction that could be by the original developer, could be by a proper amendment with the proper amount of votes. You can't just, as a board, decide to impose a restriction like that and call it a rule and put it out there and say, well, we don't allow boats on trailers and driveways anymore. You can't do that. So those are the documents that you would ask for, and certainly those should be readily available in the due diligence process when you're looking into buying a piece of property.
We're talking with Wes Collins. That was Wes right there. Wes Collins and Cecil Harvell. And Cecil started off the program pointing out that homeowners associations are a form of government, a democracy. With a few minutes left, Cecil, I'm curious, you or Wes, you know, the whole concept, this is almost like a mini MINI municipality, is it not?
It is.
Say that again, Lockwood.
A mini municipality.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Or as I mentioned earlier, democracy.
Right.
You know, absolutely. That's just the way it is, Lockwood, and it's important that we understand that. There, like so many things that in life, there certainly are advantages and disadvantages. We have clients. We all have folks who love that they live in these restricted communities where certain regulations apply, and all of the burden of homeownership doesn't just fall on them as a result of ownership. There's maintenance. There's, you know, the mowing of the sides of the grass, the keeping of the entranceway, the outdoor lighting, you know, and people love the fact that, well, we have a homeowners association and they take care of those things. They take care of the swimming pool. So, so there are a lot of advantages as well, Lockwood, but I think that the important concept is awareness, education, and then there not being any surprises, and everyone understanding exactly what they're buying into. But when you buy into an association, you have your one vote for your condominium or for your lot,
right,
whatever the rules and regulations are. You have your vote, but others have their vote as well, and you can be outvoted.
Right.
You can be you might not be in favor of there being an assessment for, you know, $10,000 to redo the surfacing of the pool. You never use the pool,
right,
you see, but yet you're a lot owner and a homeowner, and therefore you're going to have to pay your fair share.
You know, the aspect of this, and of course you mentioned condominiums as well, and of course we've seen this in circumstances associated with hurricanes and things of this nature. Again, without belaboring the issue too much, but the topic of insurance, making sure that the common areas are adequately insured. Is that part of the documentation that's available through the Homeowners Association?
Well, insurance may be certainly dealt with in the bylaws. We do have some statutes that are very particular as it relates to how insurance is dealt with in a particular association. You know, whether it's a condominium association or whether it's just a standard subdivision with residential homes in it, that they're very different there. Not to get too complicated with regard to that, but you understand, with just to contrast this somewhat, a condominium, you know, there's an obligation of the association to provide insurance because they're responsible for basically the exterior of the building. So, and then the individual's responsible for the interior inside the walls. So, you know, normally what you have higher dues with a condominium as compared to, let's say, a residential dwelling in many cases, because they're having to pay the premium for a large insurance policy covering the outside of all these condo buildings. So, yes, there are statutes in place that indicate exactly how the board and the officers for the board are required to deal with insurance proceeds in the event of a loss. I mean, for example, to make it quick, let's say you have a hurricane and you have a significant loss and they receive, you know, millions of dollars. I'll say they, I mean the board, to use to fix the damage. Well, if they decide, well, you know what, we really wanted a nice new gate,
right,
for all these years. We've got all this extra money. Let's go spend $200,000 on this beautiful gate.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're not allowed to do that. They have to actually, they have to use the money to correct the problems, and then the statute indicates that any surplus after they've corrected the the damage has to be delivered to the property owners based pro rata based on their ownership. So, you know, you kind of open up a whole
right
conversation there when we get into insurance and condominiums. But
all right, we will save that for another time. I want to thank our program host, as a matter of fact, Cecil Harvell in Wes Collins. That was Wes just a moment ago. We're talking about homeowners associations, a very important program, I might add. And I want to remind you, don't hesitate to give either Cecil or Wes a call or any of the staff. 252 area code 726-9050. The location, 1107 Bridges Street in Morehead City. And that website, harvellandcollins.com. Cecil, Wes, thank you very much. Very informative. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Lockwood.
Thank you, Lockwood.